It's Friday, November 14th, 2014, and you're listening to We the People, Constitution Matters. I'm Bruce Stocking.
And I'm Corinne Lillis.
And we are joined by our crew today of Gary Porter, Executive Director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative, Sam Rohr, President of the Pennsylvania and American Pastors Network, Charles Proctor of the law firm of Proctor and Lindsay, and in the second half of our show will be David Whitney, pastor and senior instructor of the Institute on the Constitution. And I want to start off by saying good morning, gentlemen, one and all. It's good to have the crew back together again in studio on the phone. And today we're going to be talking about something that you don't hear too much about. But when you do hear about it, it's usually during the major presidential election. And when you hear it, you hear pro and con about it. So there's a lot of people that look at this and use it as part of saying, well, because of this, my vote doesn't matter. And the whole complex of this process, which really came to light back in the election when George W. Bush defeated Al Gore in that presidential election. This was talked about a lot. And, of course, during that election, we were introduced to a new political friend. His name was Hanging Chad, and a number of other things. So we're talking the Electoral College and how the president is elected through this process, how it works. This is one you're going to have to really pay attention to, folks, because it can be a little confusing. But we have the perfect person to start explaining this for us, and it's Gary Porter, Executive Director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative. Good morning, Gary.
Good morning, Bruce.
Did you get any snow down there yesterday?
No, I don't think we're going to have any snow, but the front did come through last night. I heard it. And so I expect the temperatures will be real nippy this morning.
Well, I could probably guarantee you're going to get something eventually down there in Yorktown, Virginia, because last night we had our first dusting of snow up here in Pennsylvania.
Wow.
So, but we're all for sharing that wealth with you, of course.
Yeah.
We'll see that you get that. But, Gary, the Electoral College. This is a good one, and of course your essay on it. To tell you the truth, I had to read it twice because it is very in depth, can be very confusing, and of course with anything you do the first read, and you do that really quickly, and then you go back and do the second read a little slower, and it's like aha moment. And then, of course, you sent an article yesterday to us that we looked over that also dealt with a certain individual, which I'm sure we're going to be talking about today, Mr. George Soros getting his fingers into things. So that's your intro, and I'll let you go from there.
Well, the movement to abolish the Electoral College has been present for a long, long time, but what caught my attention was stumbling on an article that gave us an update of where this movement stood and the impetus to have it all complete by in time for the 2016 election, according to the people behind this movement. So that got me to looking at more of really why did we have the Electoral College? What was the original idea behind this in 1787 when the framers met in Philadelphia? We today think that the American people elect and were always destined to elect the president, but that's not the case, and that's not the way the system was originally set up. But it's been co-opted for such a long time that we tend to lose sight of what the original design was.
And Gary, what exactly is the original design? Does it have to do with the fact the laborious process of counting individual votes as we were just used to with these midterm elections in the state? What is that process? I don't think a lot of folks really understand that.
Well, the people at large were never intended to be involved. At least they were going to leave that decision up to the states. In Article 2 of the Constitution, the states are given full latitude as to how they are to elect electors. And the electors were initially designed to be men and women who would meet and commiserate over who really would make the best president and nominate two names. Each elector was allowed to nominate two names, and out of that pool of names would come the president. Now, the states were completely free to select a method for choosing their electors. And some, in the very first election, some of the states appointed their electors directly. Some of them put the choice of electors up to a popular vote in states where populism was popular.
Yeah.
And so there was a different method in each state, not necessarily a different method, but certainly the states had the latitude. But the bottom line was the Constitution did not envision the people being directly involved in that process, at least as a uniform way of choosing the president.
Mm-hmm.
So the electors met, they commiserated, they discussed who would make the best president, who has the integrity, the experience, the character that we're looking for in a president. And then they would send each elector would then send the two names up to the Senate. The Senate would open all of these ballots from the various electors and see which name had the most votes, if you will, or the most nominations.
Right.
If one name, one candidate, took a majority of the votes of the electors and was the highest number of votes, then that person became your president, and the person with the next highest number of votes became the vice president. So that's how we got George Washington and John Adams for the first two terms of presidency. In fact, it was unanimous for Washington, and the only president to have a unanimous vote of all the electors.
Right. Of course, I don't know. I guess it was a little bit of a run between Washington and Adams, for example, for that first choice. Am I correct with that?
Well, Washington was unanimous choice, and Adams, I don't really know how Adams became the vice president.
Well,
Washington was unanimous choice.
From my understanding in the historical past, is quite literally the second runner, the second place winner got the VP spot because the president wasn't picking his vice president. I don't believe that really came into vogue until maybe the 1800s. It was literally the second place guy. Okay, you're the VP then.
Right, and it was the election of 1800, exactly, you're right, between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, that showed the flaw in that system, that they ended up with a tie vote between the two men, and that had to be settled in the House of Representatives, as the Constitution dictates, and that led to party politics. Well,
right.
the whole problem with the Electoral College revolved around party politics. The Electoral College did not envision the influence of political parties.
Mm-hmm.
The electors were to act independently and have no influence, no outside influence. Well, that changed very quickly by 1800. We had the Federalists and the Democratic Republicans as two distinct political parties, and they influenced the electors for the very first time. They influenced the vote of these men who were to be independent, and that produced problems.
Gary, the problem I have with this is that it, again, erodes the sovereignty of the individual state. And I think that is really a critical factor here. And we keep taking away powers from the state. We keep the federal government, for example, with the Unaffordable Care Act, as Bruce calls
That's
it.
That's right. Get it right.
hey, if you don't participate in the exchanges, you're not going to get funding, and et cetera, et cetera. And this whole movement towards getting rid of the sovereignty of the individual state, I find that a real problem.
Well,
and granted, the Electoral College is confusing,
sure.
But the framers had a reason for it, and that was to maintain, as part of the whole program, the sovereignty.
Well, gentlemen, and I think it also, and I'm smelling it again, one of our first programs we did when we started this program, We the People, Constitution Matters, heard right here on 1180 AM WFYL, is we talked about the 17th Amendment and how that robbed the states of their sovereignty, at least as far as appointing senators. And with what we're dealing with now, it still seems to fall back as that being part of the infection that we're having.
Well, Sam? Certainly part of it. Yeah, go ahead, Sam. Yeah.
Well, that Gary, I think, and Bruce, I think the answer to that is the founders put a number of things into place, of which the Electoral College is one. 17th Amendment, or the senators being selected by the states, was another. The 10th Amendment to preserve the power of the states is another. There were a number of things that they put in place because I think they were very, very clear. They knew, and I was just sharing last night in a session I was teaching, and just laying out again, and referred to it here, the principles that William Penn had laid out here in Pennsylvania, the frame of government. He talked about the whole concept of the sovereignty of God, the depravity of man, the nature of government, the purpose of law, all of those things that had to be factored in. And the one thing that was very clear is that power will always tend to consolidate itself, that self-government is not the normal, it's not the default position, tyranny is the default position. And so they had to work very hard at putting in a number of different things to prevent a centralized, tyrannical form of central federal government and break everything down so that it went down as close to the people as possible, of which the states were a part, of which all of the aspects of individual state sovereignty were a part. All of those things, they put a number of things in place. So as we talk about this one here, this is but one of the efforts. And it's an amazing thing to me at how the overall effort has been to degrade nearly all of these things.
Yeah.
So the overall attack here is against, the effort was to keep a smaller central federal government and keep the power as close to the people as possible, keep it vested in the states, and all of this was a part of it. They didn't want a democracy, a direct election type of thing. This other was a part of it. So I guess all I'm saying here is that the piece we're talking about maybe a little bit complicated in its technicality, but really it fits the broader picture very, very clearly.
Gary?
Yeah, well, this whole movement has gained impetus by the results of the 2000 election, and I don't know a lot of the individuals involved, but you mentioned George Soros is heavily involved in financing it, but the whole thing is, again, an attempt to circumvent the founders' design and in place of that put something akin to democracy, pure democracy. And, of course, the founders, the framers, were directly against that. They were vehemently against democracies because they knew that democracies ultimately failed. And if we go to that, ours will be no different. It will eventually fail as well because it's inherent in the design. It is a flawed design.
So, gentlemen, are we talking here, as Sam has pointed out, and we've all pointed this out as well, is that, which this is, we are a republic, a representative government. And it just drives me crazy, and the hairs on the back of my neck stand up every time I hear elected employees and pundits and all these people calling us a democracy. And so by this electoral college, it literally, in the original design, has it for it is a representation government where the people do cast their vote. You get these electorals that are in there, and then it's decided through the representation, okay, our constituents, our people want this. This is the numbers that they're showing, and so therefore that's the way we go. Am I reading this right?
Well, yes, but it was not very far into our history that the Electoral College design was morphed by the presence of political parties, and it was the influence of political parties that degraded the system that the framers had put in place.
Mm-hmm.
Once you let political parties influence these electors, then you no longer have the design that they envisioned.
Okay. So we have found then, for example, let's look at it as a doctor and a patient here. Is the patient of the United States of America, the government, and it's been infected by a virus, and we need to get to the root of the virus. So what happened? Maybe simplify this. What happened with the political parties allowing to infect the way it has? Was this a magic pen going around Congress, let's say, routine? Or how did the infection come about, very simplistically, without getting people scratching their heads going, I need another cup of coffee here?
Well, it occurred in 1800. If you have a group of electors who are supposed to be acting independently, the chances of a tie vote are very statistically slim. That is, you will never have a tie vote unless, you know, one in a thousand. But in the 1800 election, we did have a tie vote. The Democratic Republicans had a plan to influence their electors and allow Jefferson to be selected as the president and his running mate, Aaron Burr, selected as the vice president. But they screwed up their vote and ended up all their electors casting identical votes, and they put a tie between Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr. And that tie had to be then reconciled, broken, in the House of Representatives according to the plan of Article 2. So that shows you right off the bat that the party, in this case the Democratic-Republican Party, influenced their electors in a way that the framers never intended.
Right.
The Federalists did the same. The Federalists had a plan, and they carried their plan out exactly so that John Adams had one more vote than Charles Pinckney, his running mate. And so even the Federalists were influencing their electors unnaturally. And so both parties were guilty, and both parties today, the Democrat and Republican parties, are equally guilty of adversely influencing the framers' plan of independent electors.
Chuck, jump in on this.
Yeah, Gary, what I see in this is the inherent human behavior of wanting more and more power. And the framers did not want a king. They did not want an emperor. They did not want power rested in one person or one body. And as a result, we have our checks and balances as we see them in the legislature, the judiciary, and in the administration. And yet, ever since the Constitution was formed, there's slowly been an erosion, in my opinion, towards more and more power resting in the executive branch. And we see that exemplified in President Obama. He says, hey, I don't care what Congress does. I'm going to do my thing. And as we talked about, I think it was last week even, he can recommend things to the Congress. It's his job to take a look at what's going on and say, hey, Congress, why don't you look at this issue? But he's not the one to take his pen and his phone and create legislation or create things that where the power rests solely in the Congress. And we have a judiciary that says, hey, you know, we want to get in on the act, too. And granted, as Sam could talk to us about, we've got the human nature aspect of it. People want to be powerful. But we're going in the wrong direction very quickly. And most people have been lulled asleep by, as I say, Dancing with the Stars or what's that show, Corinne, about the aspiring actors and actresses. I don't even know what it's called.
Oh, it's called It's a New Day Here? No, that's our own show.
But they've been lulled asleep by this instead of watching what's going on TV. And granted, that's slanted in its own right. Then they're looking for their slice of the pie, their slice of power. But we're slowly losing what the citizens wanted 200 years ago, 250 years ago. It's going away, and I think
you're
that's
exactly
a huge problem.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're exactly right, and this is a movement towards a king, definitely. When right now the president, typically most modern presidents have felt like and talked like they were elected by the people, when in fact they're not. They're elected by the electors. Mm-hmm. But this will remove the influence of the electors entirely. This will put the selection of the president up to a national popular vote. That's why it's got that name in the movement. Mm-hmm. And once the people that are directly electing the president, then yes, you will have a move towards giving him more power than he presently has and move toward a king.
Well,
absolutely.
Quite frankly, with the way things are going with this current administration and this current president, and now with this looming threat over our heads of him yet going around Congress once again with his magic pen and executive power with this amnesty for illegals, I think myself that a lot of people in this country are probably to the point similar to what happened after Nixon was president, where there was actually some movement there to limit the authority and power of the president. I can see that coming up again. Now, we're going to be taking a break in just a few minutes. What do we have left, Corinne?
We have about 2 minutes left.
2 minutes left. And so I want to get into talking about the people, Chuck was talking about, and Sam, your thoughts on that. If you could start, we'll take a break and come back with you.
I'll just throw one thing in at this point about a people. I'll just show, before I get to that question, I could answer
okay.
just a few seconds here. There is another reason that this push for this direct popular vote, it doesn't just consolidate power in the executive branch and so forth, but to me, it absolutely opens up the potential for voter fraud gigantically enormous way, so that you could actually load up representation and votes coming from one state, control one state, and you could tip the balance of power. And so there are a lot of problems with this, all of those which do go towards the consolidation of federal power and a king. And I can't think of any single good reason why, other than foul play here, that we'd want to go this direction.
Yeah, well, then we're talking about something that I've heard a lot of people talk about, and I talked about it myself here with this past election, with what you were saying with one state controlling it all. It's almost like here in Pennsylvania, for example, if you look at Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, the way they
absolutely
vote, and it goes. But, Chuck, you had a thought?
Well, Bruce, I was going to jump in. Particularly here on the East Coast, we have people that live and work in Pennsylvania, but they have a vacation home in New Jersey or Maryland or Delaware. Mm-hmm. And I know for a fact, I see it in my practice, people will live and work here, but they will have their insurance, their checking account, and their voter registration in New Jersey.
Yeah.
And it skews the whole idea. And on top of that, irrespective of the fact that supposedly DMVs check when you go for a driver's license in New Jersey, they're supposed to check Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
I can't tell you how many people have multiple driver's licenses.
Yeah,
so that when they get suspended in Pennsylvania, they whip out New Jersey or Ohio or whatever it is.
Wow.
And I'm not picking on any particular state,
but
it's a real problem. So you can vote in the morning in Philadelphia and then turn around and drive into Jersey and vote in New Jersey. So
okay. It
just lends to what Sam was saying.
Yeah, let's hold on these thoughts. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back. You're listening to We the People, Constitution Matters, right here on 1180 AM WFYL. Stay with us. We'll be right back. We the People of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. And thanks for sticking with us through the break. You're listening to We the People, Constitution Matters. I'm Bruce Stocking.
And I'm Corinne Lillis.
And we're joined by Gary Porter, Executive Director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative, Sam Rohr, President of the Pennsylvania and American Pastors Network, Charles Proctor, the law firm of Proctor & Lindsay, and we're hoping in this part of the program to be joined in a little bit by David Whitney, who's pastor and senior instructor of the Institute on the Constitution. And before the break, our topic today is, of course, the Electoral College in this country. And we're talking about the process itself. The process can be a bit confusing to understand how it works out. Some may think that, well, then I'm not voting for the president. I'm not being represented. And we're trying to get through this for you can understand the process itself. And there's a movement afoot to say goodbye to that and have it all on a popular vote. And that's kind of where we left off. And we were talking about the character of people themselves in this, that corruption can come in, and voter fraud. And Sam, before we went to the break, you were talking along these lines. So if you want to continue the thoughts that you had on there that bring up.
Well, I can. Yes, you know, we were talking about, obviously, we're those who are listening, understanding that we're putting forth the rationale of why this push to eliminate the Electoral College is not wise. But I just raised one of the other reasons for the fact that that if, in fact, it is, and you go to a direct popular vote where it's the total vote of the nation rather than the individual representation of the votes of the various states that actually elect, knowing that, the process by which we're now voting is very electronically based, which we already know that the system has been hacked on many occasions, and we know that people are hacking right directly into the White House, into the Pentagon. This whole system gives rise very, very carefully or very easily to tampering. And at the end of the day, you could have, as I was saying, you could have a particular state where all of a sudden you have 110% of the people vote like they did in Philadelphia in the past. So yeah. Understand, it has happened that you've had more people vote than actually live there. But the ability to take, and if this shift is made, you could have significant tampering in one or two states occur that you'd have just 50,000 more votes than the other guy.
Yeah, and Sam,
you win, and it's absolutely illegitimate, and it's been a stealing of the election.
Yeah, and Sam, you look at with Philadelphia, for example, what was it in the last presidential election when Obama got elected the second time? They reported a precinct in Philadelphia being 100% for Obama, which I find literally impossible in itself. Mm-hmm. So I see where you're going, Gary.
Yeah, I'm glad that Sam brought up this idea of multiple registrations in multiple states, because there was a Virginia voters group that found that 44,000 Virginians are also registered to vote in Maryland. How's that grab you?
Yeah. Well,
now, and if you look at the 2000 election, the 2000 election came down to 387 votes, really, even though nationwide the two men were separated by 500,000 votes. It really came down to Florida, and Florida was decided on 387 votes. So yeah. If you've got 44,000 Virginians also registered in Maryland, how easy is it to swing an election?
Well, let's talk about Maryland, because on the phone line with us as well is David Whitney, pastor and senior instructor of the Institute on the Constitution. Good morning, David. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well, and we are a state that now has proof that vote fraud is taking place. Not only the 40,000 that Gary was mentioning, that's been proven, but in addition to that, there's a lawsuit currently against the state of Maryland, specifically focused on Frederick, Maryland, that county. They have proof that non-citizens are voting in Frederick County. They've thousands of these prove that when they sent these, the problem in Maryland is you register to vote when you get a driver's license, and now they give driver's license to illegals. So many illegals are voting, and they proved it by looking at all the returns from jury duty forms. When somebody's going to be summoned for jury duty, they're sent a form. One of the check boxes on the form says, "I am not a U.S. citizen." They compared those returns with the people who actually voted, and the proof is that illegals are voting in this state. And if it's happening in this state, it's probably happening all across the country, which they know.
Yeah. Well, David, let me ask you this. Of course, that showing your ID at the poll to vote and so forth, you know, we don't want to disenfranchise people, but to check a book out from a library, you have to show it. does that have anything to do with this? And also, is this also a focus? Because in Maryland, you all did something historic. You've got a Republican governor coming up.
Yes, which is shows that in spite of the vote fraud, the people here in this state at least are very upset with the big government taxing, ridiculous kind of things that the Democrats have been putting forward. So the vote fraud, in spite of the fact that it certainly sways many elections, still is not large enough, at least in our state, to turn things around. That's the second time in 40 years we've had a Republican in the governor's mansion coming up next year. So that's exciting. But to take a step back on the Electoral College, and I don't know if this has been discussed, so let me know if this has already been talked about. There was a parallel in that the state legislatures, until the 17th Amendment, the state legislatures appointed the senators. The people did not vote directly for their senators because the state legislature was to have a direct control over one house in Congress. That is, they could determine whether a bill passes Congress or not, instructing their senators. The senators represented the state legislators. They could tell the senators how to vote, and if the senators chose not to vote the way the state legislature said, they could be fired and replaced by whomever the state legislature chose.
Now
in a parallel, well, the states were to have a direct control over the election of the president, and that's what the Electoral College was all about.
Right.
The executive branch was not to be independent of the state governments, but instead the state governments would have a direct voice in who became president. So even if the popular vote in their state was something different, they could, because the legislature was the one that determined how the electoral representatives on the Electoral College were chosen, they could instruct them and they could choose a different president. This is something that many people abhor when they hear about it, but that really was the design.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want a president independent of the states. We don't want a Senate independent of the state governments.
Right. And that, you know, and this is what, Gary, you've been bringing up with this as well. You know, with the fact that this is a republic and not a democracy. And your thoughts on what David just said.
Well, yes. And we go back to what was the mindset of the framers. They wanted this electoral process to be free from outside influence. They wanted the electors to be able to meet and commiserate and independently come up with these nominations of two individuals to be president. The electors were to be men of integrity, men of character, and the whole process was to be above populism. It was to be above, to ride above the waves of populism that were sweeping the country. So we're moving away from that. We're moving towards populism and direct votes to put the presidents in place, and that's a move exactly in the opposite direction of what the framers envisioned for this country.
Yeah, Chuck?
Well, Gary, you know, the other thing that's happened here is the media has portrayed the Electoral College as a group of puppets that just show up on, what is it, December 3rd or 6th or whatever in Washington and cast their vote irrespective of anything, and that it's a mere formality, a perfunctory duty that they perform. And that is not the case. And I think the press has to be informed and they have to report properly to the people the function of the Electoral College. And it's not just an exercise in their mind in futility.
Well, Chuck, you bring up a good point.
Let me add on to that.
Sure,
in some states, it has become a perfunctory process because that state has enacted law that requires the elector to vote the way the people in that state have. And in fact, if he goes against the popular vote, he's subject to a felony prosecution in some states. So the process has been corrupted in many instances across the nation, and it needs to be restored to the founders' design.
Yeah, and you're exactly right. And with the media aspect on there, you know, we take a look at the writings of Thomas Jefferson, for example, and all of them, they talk about the importance. In fact, they felt it was so important to put in the First Amendment, the freedom of the press, because the press is there to monitor these officials, kind of hold them accountable, and to inform the public of what's going on. And of course, nowadays, as we see, even currently, with this situation with this professor that was one of the chief architects of the Unaffordable Care Act, who they've got four videos now of this guy saying how stupid the American voter is, and we need to just bamboozle them to get this through because this has to be done. and the reports you look now on the major news network that people are watching is that ABC, NBC, CBS, no report whatsoever on this, but talk radio, cable, Fox is covering it. And that tells you right there the corruption that you were saying on there and the legality end of it. Chuck, you have
another.
Yeah, go ahead, Dave.
Another point on the corruption is the original design is very different than what we have today. Today, except in two states, I believe it's Maine and I think it's Minnesota, but I'm not actually sure about the second one, but definitely in Maine, your elector, that is the person who's going to represent you in the Electoral College, is not a winner-take-all statewide. Yeah. It's a winner in your congressional district. That is, if your district votes for the Republican, in spite of the fact you might be in a deeply blue state like here in Maryland, if your congressional district votes for the Republican, you have a Republican elector in the Electoral College. This would be a far fairer system than the winner-takes-all system, which skews everything across the country and doesn't give people a true representation on the Electoral College. And it could be changed because, obviously, two states are still doing it. It was done traditionally in America, but the states over time changed it to a winner-take-all strategy. Now, the only difference with that would be, of course, there's two additional electors that are parallel to the two senators that state has. They would be a winner-take-all in the winner-take-all category, but everybody else would be on the basis of their congressional district and how their congressional district voted.
Yeah, Sam, your thoughts on this?
Well, that's something that I know there are a lot of states talking about doing that. That's, it was a consideration before the House and Senate here in Pennsylvania. It hasn't happened yet, but I'm glad you brought that up, David, because, and you did voice your opinion on it, but that tends to be, I think, as you're saying, even more reflective of the will of the people, breaking it down so that it's not the direct popular vote overall. I'm just curious if any of you that's a part of the group here this morning have any concern about that. If that were the direct, because obviously you've got this overall effort by the president and others mm-hmm. to try and go to the direct national yeah. vote. In most cases, there needs to be, if there's a big push, there almost needs to be another alternative there, either hold the line or say, here's a better way. Do you think that way of going to the either the congressional district, do you see any problem with that at all?
I'm really torn on this, honestly, because there needs to be, among the American people, a greater engagement, a greater education level, a greater involvement in their government. That is pure and simply what has to happen. But at the same time, I'm very alarmed at giving uneducated people this immense power of electing their president directly. If you look at any of these video polls or man on the street polls, and you ask people who's the sitting vice president, they all know.
You've watched Waters World as well as I have on the Riley Actor, haven't you?
Right, and these people vote. So I'm very, very leery about giving people who are uneducated and don't take the time to become educated the immense power of directly electing their president. At the same time, I want them to become educated. I want them to become engaged and involved so that we can have a more representative government. So I'm really torn by this whole thing.
Chuck?
Gary, I agree with you. I'm torn as well because of the level of education of our electorate. But I think David's right. This might be a way to get people involved. If they realize that their vote for the for a congressman has a direct impact on the Electoral College, you would think that would tend to bring them around. Of course, we have the situation we talked about, voter fraud and precincts, and particularly in the big cities that have very, very controlled results. I think I'm being kind there, but and that could be an issue. But that goes to the next issue of, and Gary, I'm sure you've heard about this, increasing the number of congressmen, because originally the number of congressmen was supposed to represent a certain number of people in the United States. Now it's impossible.
Just keep one thing in mind, Chuck. Congress right now has an approval rating of 13%.
Exactly.
I just thought I'd throw that in.
Exactly. but there's that movement to increase the number of congressmen, and perhaps people would feel more connected. I don't know. Gary, I share your thoughts. It could go both ways. But, David, you've got an excellent point there.
Yeah. And I want to bring in one other person to get thoughts in this. Corinne, you've been sitting there listening to this. I'm sure you're quite puzzled. What's your thoughts?
Well, I definitely agree with a lot of what Chuck just said, because I think people don't really understand exactly how it works. So if they had a better understanding of what sort of impact that has, I think maybe that would motivate them more to go out and vote and take it seriously. So I don't know. But at the same time, I think Gary brings up a really good point, too, with that you want people to be informed about it, because right now it's like you want them to vote, but then you go out and you hear what they're saying on the media and on television, so it's like, I really actually don't want them to vote. But I think educating people more, whether that's starting, well, like Sam has said before, in the churches and also is in the schools, and ultimately I think it's the parents' responsibility, because if the schools and the churches aren't doing it, you know, the parent has to make a decision there to educate your child. But I think just the more that people understand it better, I think it's just something that's been swept under the rug for a long time. So I think that's where the root of the problem is.
Yeah, and David, you know, considering we've heard from our panel here, our contributors on this and yourself on this, but it comes down to the fact, isn't it, that you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink.
That's right, and that reminds me that maybe listeners in your area would be interested to know, I'm going to be talking about that proportional representation, what the constitutional standard is, why that standard was changed, and so on the 18th of November, next Tuesday night, in Lebanon, Pennsylvania. And I think that's probably in the listening area, so if folks are interested in that, it's the Lebanon 912 group and 302 East Lehman Street in Lebanon, Pennsylvania, starting at 6:30 on Tuesday evening, November 18th. If people want more information, they can go to our website, The American View. But we'll be talking about that exactly, and the difficulty of restoring a proportional representation as our Constitution calls for, and what possible solutions there could be to this problem that we are truly underrepresented by what the constitutional standard is, supposed to be 1 to 30,000, that's 30,000 citizens or 30,000 residents, actually, represented by one congressman, and today the standard is 1 to 750,000 is what the standard is now. So getting educated really is essential, and so we'd invite folks, if they are available November 18th at 6:30 in the Lebanon, Pennsylvania area. That's 302 East Lehman Street. And by the way, at Institute on the Constitution, we offer all sorts of resources that people can access. Some of those are online, other of those are DVD-based, but there is available resources for people to get educated. So the excuse that it's too difficult or complicated, I think we have answered that, and hope people will take advantage of that at theamericanview.com.
Yeah, Chuck, I think this falls into ignorance is no excuse for the law.
Absolutely. That's where I was headed, along with the other concept of the 30,000 that David mentioned were men, because women had not been extended the vote. Children weren't counted, so it was 30,000 men. Now, when you take the fact that we have 18-year-olds voting, we have women voting, which is absolutely appropriate, and you combine that all together, that 30,000 number, although it may have increased in colonial times, is now an entirely different representation. And that, and I hate to fall far off from the subject, but gerrymandering.
Yeah.
I've seen diagrams of districts that is absolutely ridiculous, and yet with gerrymandering, it's approved by the each judiciary in every state. And when you talk about ignorance, people don't know that their district may cover two different counties, three counties, many municipalities, and cover a wide range of the population. The idea was that, you know, for example, Delaware County and Chester County in Pennsylvania and Montgomery County are three distinct counties. They each have their own personality, their own population. But now we have congressmen that cross those county lines and cross those populations and cross the interests of the citizens.
Yeah.
So when you talk about educating people, we have to go way back, Bruce, and to a very fundamental level and educate people and stop having, and again, it goes back to control, somebody wanting to have the power. We have to go back to those fundamentals so that people will say, hey, we don't want the gerrymandering. We want proper representation in proportion to what the Constitution provides, and take it from there in electing whether it's the president, a senator. David mentioned the 17th Amendment and the problems there, in addressing all those issues.
Yeah, and how do we inspire people to want to get educated? Because I think even if, look, like David, when he was saying there's all these resources out there, there's no excuse. But if people aren't willing to listen, then I think then, I mean, how do we inspire them to really want to get educated and really take it to heart and then go from there?
Well, let's go to Sam here, you know, with that and also with the districts and so forth. So, Sam?
Well, I'll answer your question, Corinne, just one second. But I will say, David, when you come up to Pennsylvania, is discussing very, very strongly reducing the number of representatives in the House and the Senate in Pennsylvania right now, which actually goes directly against what you were just saying and what we've been talking about. We don't have enough congressmen. We have to understand in all the discussion that there is a principle underneath it here that the founders were trying to employ. I think it's a teaching of principles that really helped to cement the different things in place. What they were trying to resist was a centralized federal government. They did not want tyranny. It was all to protect self-government and all that kind of thing. But here in Pennsylvania, the political discussion has entered in which many people say it's too expensive of government. And therefore, we want to demonstrate to the people that we are sensitive to the taxpayer, and we therefore will take and reduce the size of the House and the Senate. The problem is that, obviously, there are many portions of the state that would lose representation. So what's the principle? Well, you've got to have enough representation. You can't have too expensive a government. But at the end of the day, these things all factor together. What are we trying to preserve? What are we trying to maintain? I think that needs to be always kept for us.
One of the things that's interesting by comparison, I think it's New Hampshire has mm-hmm. the closest representation. You know, maybe it's every 1,000 registered voters, there's one representative, and they pay them very little. I mean, basically, the people are serving at their own expense. There's, you know, a very small pay. So perhaps one way to reduce the cost is to reduce the pay of those. Now, Sam, you might take offense at that, having served in Harrisburg. I'm not sure.
Well, all I know is that the principle is a workman's worthy of their hire. So what you do is if they do the work, you pay them. But if you have limited government and you don't have them spend much time there, like in Texas, then you don't need to pay them as much.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
true.
Yeah, good points. But the Corinne's question that she had, we've got just a few minutes.
I think that ties into what you just said, Sam. What are we trying to preserve and what are we trying to maintain? Because that's definitely the core.
Yeah, and we're rapidly coming to an end here. So I want to give Gary the last word. Gary?
Well, Corinne's problem is the central problem. How do you educate the American people? And frankly, I'd love to devote a whole hour to that sometime, because that is the core problem, and that's what fundamentally has to be fixed first. We have to educate the people. We not only do we have to show them what the founders' original intent was, we have to show them why that was so wise. Why we should return to that, and I frankly don't have the final answer on this. I don't know how to reach out to people, but that is the core, and that is the root problem we need to address first.
Well, perhaps next Friday we can start that with the education end of it. We're getting to the point where a lot of things that we have talked about, it all seems to fall on, you know, the educating of the public. Of course, that's why we're here. And also, we've identified again, you know, and I said in the very beginning of this, when we started this program, the 17th Amendment was the big cancer. And we've identified that. So there are a lot of things. So, Gary, you think the education is of the public?
Yeah, we can take a stab at that. I'm sure David will have some thoughts on that. Since that's their focus at American View.
Yep. Well, tell you what, why don't we make a deal here that next Friday we get together at 7 o'clock as we're doing in the morning, and we venture down that road. Gentlemen, all in agreement?
Absolutely.
There you go. There you
now,
go.
Bruce, one thing to close on.
Yes.
Since Sam mentioned that a workman is worthy of his hire, does that mean that Gary and Sam and Dave and I all get a raise?
We're going to increase what you currently are making right now.
Oh, that's terrific.
Yeah, I guess. A lot of zeros, but no other numbers. Yeah. But I'd like to thank everybody for listening to We the People Constitution Matters. We've been talking with Gary Porter, Executive Director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative, Sam Rohr, President of the Pennsylvania and the American Pastors Network, Charles Proctor, law firm of Proctor & Lindsay, and David Whitney, pastor and senior instructor of the Institute on the Constitution. I'd also like to thank my co-host, Corinne Lillis. This is Bruce Stocking. It is Friday. The weekend's upon us. It's going to be a little cool out there, but go out there and enjoy it with your family. And remember, Constitution matters, but we the people matter. See you next week.